And Radio Derb is on the air. Sort of. This is not a normal Radio Derb. For a normal Radio Derb, I sit down on Friday and pass comment on the week's news. When I'm done, we post it to the vdare.com website and on iTunes. That's not what is happening this week. I am, in fact, far away. Far away from my recording equipment. In the first week of a 3-week holiday in China. I have deliberately gone off the grid for these 3 weeks. This podcast and those for the next 2 weeks were pre-recorded and stored in the capacious vaults at vdare.com world headquarters to be brought out and posted on site around midnight each Friday according to the usual Radio Derb schedule. In the nature of things, therefore, this and the next 2 weeks' podcasts must eschew topicality. Instead, they will be trips down memory lane with your remotely genial host, John Derbyshire. Radio Derb has now been on the air more than 15 years, since May of 2004. All the sound files and all the transcripts are archived on my personal website, johndarbyshire.com. Click on Opinions. In case you can't remember how to spell my name, you can also get directly to my website by entering dissidentright.com. There are now more than 700 of those transcripts, each one with a sound file embedded in it. For the last few months, I've been toiling away to bring them under a standard format for ease of reading, listening, and linking. I started back there in May 2004 and have been plodding steadily forward. As I head off on my vacation this week, I have reached June 2012. Radio Derb started off in 2004 being hosted by National Review Online. National Review dropped me 8 years later in April 2012. So my standardisation effort now encompasses the entire 8 years I podcast from National Review Online. Those 8 years included, amongst, of course, many other events, 2.5 presidential election cycles. So, for these 3 weeks that I'm away from the microphone, I'm just going to post assembled clips of segments gathered from those 8 years. I'll be cutting and pasting the sound clips right out of the original audio files, so sound quality might be somewhat variable. I'll do my best to even it out. I'll bracket each segment with a couple of quick pips, so you'll know when it's 2019 Derb talking and when it's 2004 or 2008 or 2012 Derb. Each of these 3 weeks' podcasts will have a theme. Because this is vdare.com and our main issue is immigration, I'll give over this first week's podcast to things I was saying about immigration topics in those 8 years, 2004 to 2012. Here we go. I wanted to start with something from 2004. Reviewing the transcripts, it turns out I didn't have much to say about immigration in 2004. I did, however, do a Christmas sing-along for NRO that year. Spoof lyrics that I made up to familiar tunes, mainly Christmas carols. My songs had titles like God Rest You, Yasser Arafat, and Frosty the Candidate. That was a reference to John Kerry. I posted all those lyrics at NRO, but Radio Derb was still just a 10-minute affair, so not all of them got recorded at the time. This one I sang on Radio Derb a couple of years later, May 2006. I'm going to claim it as a 2004 contribution, though.
Ah, now I've got you worked up, haven't I? There's nothing Radio Derb readers enjoy more than a good sing-along. Here's an old favourite, the Song of the Illegal Immigrants. We'll be pouring through the border when we come, when we come. We'll be pouring through the border when we come, when we come. We'll be pouring through the border to hell with law and order. We'll be pouring through the border when we come. If you're ranching near the border when we come, watch out, chum. Best lock up your wife and daughter when we come. Don't be dumb, and don't go to fix your fences. There's no point in such expenses. We'll just break 'em down and burn 'em when we come. We'll be filling up your hospitals and schools, all your schools. We don't care about your pettifogging rules, fogging rules. When to pay your tax you're straining, think of all your nation's gaining. What's the point of more explaining, you poor fools? Every guilty rich white liberal needs a maid. It's free trade, small and meek, so there's no need to feel afraid, unafraid. One who'll work all kinds of hours, mow the lawn and tend the flowers, and won't argue if she's grossly underpaid. Being brown and poor, we make the lefties swoon. Lefties swoon! If you grumble, that's just racist, they'll impugn. Leave the room! If you protest, you're a bigot, so just open up that spigot, and we'll have you talking Spanish pretty soon. Sure, a lot of us come here to practice crime, practice crime. In your prisons we're a dozen for a dime, doing time. But a prison cell in Utah beats a farm in Pitiquito, and your prison guards can use that over time. In any case, this country isn't yours. No, not yours. Just remember all those cruel and unjust wars and racist laws. Your forefathers stole our nation. This is just repatriation. We've come here to stay and also settle scores.
The Republican Party got well and truly beaten in the 2006 midterm elections. They lost both the House and the Senate. President George W. Bush gave a post-defeat presser. Here's some commentary from Radio Derb, November 10th, 2006.
The only moment in his post-defeat press conference where the president seemed to perk up a little was when he was asked about the prospects for immigration legislation. Yes, folks, get ready for the 2007 Clinton, Kennedy, Bush, Open Border, Amnesty, and Abolition of Citizenship Act. Jim Gilchrist, head of the Minuteman organization that's trying to do the job our federal government won't do, which is to say guard the borders, was on Fox and Friends Thursday morning. Quote from Jim, "There is no intention on the part of the White House or the Democratic Party to enforce our immigration laws or preserve our sovereignty." End quote. You said it, Jim. The Democrats' strategy is simple. Number one, bring in as many immigrants as possible from third world countries with statist political attitudes. Number two, to give these people citizenship, ASAP, so they can vote. If you grew up in a country untouched by Anglo-American concepts of liberty and self-support, you're going to go head over heels for the Democrats' welfare statism, not to mention their racial favoritism and identity politics. It's easy to see why the Democrats want open borders and the 120 to 150 million third world immigrants that Jim estimates will come here in the next 20 years? Why George W. Bush is on board with this program of national suicide is more of a mystery. In any case, the big push will come next year. Everyone who cares about the future of this country should limber up to start pushing back. Even with the Democrats holding Congress, this can be stopped. There is no real constituency for it among the American people at large. And there's a passionate constituency against it, including a lot of Democrats. We can stop this. Si se puede.
In all those years of commentary about immigration at National Review, did I give any shout-outs to vdare.com? Indeed I did. I was a freelancer, never a salaried employee of the magazine, and I contributed to all sorts of other outlets, including vdare.com. I had been contributing to vdare since year 2000. After Bill Buckley died in early 2008, and vdare published what the National Review suits thought were unacceptably disrespectful remarks about him, the magazine blacklisted vdare. I didn't contribute to vdare again after that until 2012, when National Review blacklisted me. So, here I was in June of 2007, giving vdare a shout-out by way of celebrating the failure in Congress of the appalling anti-American immigration reform bill of that year. The brainchild, although the word brain isn't really appropriate here, the brainchild of George W. Bush and Edward M. Kennedy. Birthright citizenship. I can't believe we're talking about this stuff. One good thing that's come out of this ludicrous Senate immigration bill is a real educational experience for a lot of people about immigration issues. It's fun to see things that immigration wonks have been chewing over for years suddenly in the public square being debated, or at least mentioned. The political and business elites hate this, of course. They don't want people talking about immigration or knowing anything about it. That's why they brought this bill to the Senate floor without any hearings or discussion. They don't just want to open our borders and amnesty 12 million trespassers. They want to do it all in the dead of night, silently and secretly. What a shameful business it's been. What an insight we've had into the contempt that our ruling classes feel towards us rubes. As I am recording this, the second cloture motion has failed and it looks as though the bill will go down in flames. Then what will the administration do without this raft of new laws they were planning? Start serious enforcement of existing laws? Well, that's probably too much to hope for. Still, if public anger keeps rising as it has been, keeping steady pressure on the administration, they might grudgingly do a little law enforcement, venting their anger and frustration at being made to do the jobs we pay them to do by periodically telling us what nativist yahoos we are. And, you know, railroading a few Border Patrol agents into jail on trumped-up charges. Well, the failure of this horrible bill is the best thing that's happened in politics this year. Congratulations to all who helped to bring this beast down. Lou Dobbs, Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham, Michelle Malkin, all the other commentators and bloggers, and of course a special thanks to the wonks who've been pegging away at this crucial issue in the shadow of intense elite disapproval for years past.
crunching the numbers and making the case. People like the Center for Immigration Studies, Numbers USA, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, VDARE, and I'm sure others I've forgotten. Thanks and congratulations. This has been a victory for popular democracy. America has dodged a bullet.
Here's another segment from 2007, a short one. The precise topic here is the refugee rackets. For full and comprehensive documentation of which, across many years, I refer you to the bloggings of Anne Corcoran, currently at the website Frauds, Crooks and Criminals, formerly at Refugee Resettlement Watch. As Anne has uncovered many, many times over in exhaustive detail, the entire refugee resettlement business is a scam. Worse than that, in fact, it's a scam run by the United Nations. That we permit this hustle to operate on our territory is a standing disgrace to our elected representatives and our public officials.
You know, sometimes you find yourself reading something that makes you think, is this for real? Or was it taken from one of J.R.R. Tolkien's notebooks? Example, I'm reading the Wikipedia entry for a certain country. Quotes, several principal ethnic groups may be distinguished. The second dominant group is the Ngalops. The Ngalops, a Buddhist group based in the western part of the country. Their culture is closely related to that of Tibet. Much the same could be said of the Sharchops, the dominant group, who are associated with the eastern part of the country, but who traditionally follow the Nyingmapa rather than the official Drukpa Kagyu form of Tibetan Buddhism. The national language is Dzongkha, one of 53 languages in the Tibetan language family. The script is called Chokhi, identical with the Tibetan script, and so on and so on. Now, what country is that? Hands up if you know. Yes, that boy in the back? Right, it's Bhutan. Bhutan, up there in the Himalayas. Well, Americans, you'd better brush up your Chokhi and make sure that you know a Sharchop from a Ngalop, because as many as 60,000 Bhutanese refugees will be settling in the USA soon. That's according to a decision reached by the International Organization for Migration, officials from the government of Nepal, which is next door to Bhutan, and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Yes, folks, 60,000 polygamous Himalayan goat herds will be adding diversity to a town near you, courtesy of the UN. What's that you say? You want the actual American people and their actual representatives to have some say about who gets let into our country?
In commenting on immigration, I haven't restricted myself to the USA. When the immigration policies of other nations present some kind of model for what ours should be, I promote them, as I did here in November 2007.
Mind you, and incredible as it seems to me, we Brits are not always given the welcome that we are rightfully entitled to, as sometimes civilizers of the whole world. Here's a very sad story from New Zealand. New Zealand, it says here, I'm reading from the November 20th Daily Telegraph, New Zealand is critically short of skilled workers, and many large firms are intensively recruiting in Britain. So far, so good. The kind of immigrant they're looking for would be somebody like Mr. Richie Trezice, a highly qualified specialist in undersea cable work. Being a long way from anywhere, New Zealand has lots of undersea cables to tend, and expertise in this area is in short supply. So, off goes Mr. Trezice, waving Shakespeare's island goodbye to settle down under among the Kiwis. Next thing, he naturally wants his wife to join him. Here, however, things went, as the British say, somewhat pear-shaped. To qualify as an immigrant into New Zealand, you see, your body mass index, your BMI, that's your weight divided by the square of your height, in kilograms and metres, please, your BMI has to fall within a certain range. If you're too thin or too fat, New Zealand won't let you in. The logic there is that too fat or too thin people are likely to be burdens on the health services. Mrs. Trezice is fat. She's not chubby. She's not well upholstered. She's not cuddly or zaftig. She's fat. Too fat to settle in New Zealand, say the authorities. None of the newspapers will tell us what Mrs. Trezice's weight actually is, nor even her BMI, for that matter. But it's obvious from the pictures that treadmills, stairmasters, and exercise bikes are not key appurtenances of Mrs. Trezice's lifestyle. Even Mr. Trezice himself had trouble passing the immigration test initially, having a BMI of 42. Which means, if you assume that he's the average British male height of 5'10", it means he was nudging 300 pounds. Mr. Trezice shaped up, however, and he has now been admitted as an immigrant to New Zealand. But poor Mrs. Trezice is still stuck firmly in New Zealand's front door. It's a sad story, but you know what? As unfair as New Zealand's immigration policies may be to fat people, at least they have immigration policies.
Among the loudest opponents of proper, humane immigration law enforcement are our churches. The villains in this segment from February 2008 were Methodists, Southern Methodist University down in Dallas, and one particular Methodist church in Chicago.
I'm starting to build up an issues file with the Methodists. If you're a Methodist, please bear with me here. I know that some very fine people are Methodists. Hillary Clinton, and I'm sure many others. Anyway, first, I get this news story that Southern Methodist University down there in Dallas is balking at being the home for the George W. Bush Presidential Library. To add insult to injury, SMU is Laura Bush's alma mater. Here's a quote from the Associated Press story, quote, "United Methodist law requires approval from the church's South Central jurisdiction, whose 290 delegates meet in July. The opponents say that at least one-third of the delegates are against the Bush Library because it will promote his administration's policies that they feel conflict with church teachings." End quote. Now, I guess I'd have to say I'm not the world's biggest George W. Bush fan, but the guy got elected president twice, with a vote from me the second time, and he did his best for the country, according to his lights. He's entitled to a library, guys. Come on. And then, from Chicago, here we go again with the Adalberto United Methodist Church giving sanctuary to an illegal immigrant propagandist. This was the church that sheltered Open Borders activist Elvira Arellano for a year, in defiance of a federal deportation order. Their new customer is 28-year-old Flor Crisostomo, who, like Ms. Arellano, is an unmarried mother. Her three kids are living back in Mexico with their granny. So, as well as not holding the nation's immigration laws in very high esteem, or in any esteem at all, this Methodist church apparently doesn't think much of the sanctity of marriage either. If I were a Methodist, I'd be hiding my head under the pillows after reading these stories. Don't Methodist bishops have any authority over shenanigans like this? On the other hand, if the Methodist bishops actually approve of this church promoting illegal immigration, then what's their problem with hosting the George W. Bush Library? Old W. is the illegal immigrant's best friend, after all. Memo to future illegal immigrant single mothers. Instead of holing up in this pokey, cold Chicago church, why don't you head for the Bush Presidential Library? Seems to me you'd be just as welcome there. It's in a much better climate, and you won't be short of something to read while you wait the year or so it takes the immigration authorities to get their acts together.
The USA is, we like to boast, a nation of laws, not men. It doesn't matter who you are, rich or poor, high or low, well-connected or unconnected, you will be treated equally under the law. For those of us who cherish that ideal, one of the most outrageous stories from the past few years was the favoritism shown to Barack Obama's relatives. Obama's aunt and uncle were both shameless immigration scofflaws. Both were treated with tender consideration by our courts. I passed comment on them several times. Here's a segment from September 2011.
Speaking of illegal immigrants, which I was a segment or two ago, here's another one. Obama Onyango. Mr. Onyango was arrested August 24th outside Chicken Bone Saloon. That's a fried chicken shop in Framingham, Massachusetts. Mr. Onyango was not arrested for being illegally present in the United States. Good heavens, we don't arrest people for that. He was arrested because he narrowly missed colliding with a patrol car, and when breathalyzed was found to have twice the legal limit of alcohol in his system. Wait a minute, though. What was that other name there? Obama? Yes, this is yet another twig on our president's colourful family tree. Mr. Onyango is actually Barack Obama's half-uncle. Same grandfather, different grandmother. He came here in 1963 on a student visa and just stayed, obtaining a Social Security card and driver's license by means unknown. Mr. Onyango has mostly kept a low profile, though there have been a couple of brushes with the authorities. An immigration judge ordered him deported in 1989. Mr. Onyango appealed, but lost his appeal in 1992. He just stayed anyway. Meanwhile, the IRS had filed a lien against him for $4,000 in unpaid taxes in 1990. It all sounds a lot like Barack Obama's aunt Zaituni Onyango, who was likewise living here illegally. Aunt Zaituni was ordered deported in 2004, but like Mr. Onyango, she just ignored the order. When push came to shove, an unknown benefactor, hired the nation's best immigration attorney to represent Aunt Zaituni, and a spineless judge
gave her political asylum on the grounds that anyone related to the President of the United States would be mercilessly persecuted by the authorities if forced to return to her native country. She now lives in public housing on public benefits and occupies her time buying designer clothes and accessories in upscale stores in between visits to the welfare office. Mr. Onyango has been working for the last 5 years at a liquor store, so it seems from his recent arrest that he's been ignoring the Scarface rule. Don't get high on your own supply. He's actually had a couple of encounters with the law while serving behind the counter there for selling liquor to underage customers. If this were a nation of laws, not men, Obama Onyango would be on the next plane back to Kenya, with Aunt Zaituni Onyango in the seat right behind. As it is, this is a country where powerful people and their relatives can do as they please, as these cases amply illustrate. Just like any other banana republic, in fact.
Obama's Aunt Zaituni died from natural causes in Boston, 2014, aged 61. His uncle was granted permanent residence in 2013. Here is an immigration-related segment from one of the last radio derbs I did while at National Review. The date here is March 16th, 2012. The subject is the trial of Edwin Ramos in San Francisco. If you've forgotten the name, that's entirely excusable at this distance in time, but I give full background for the case in the segment.
I mentioned Edwin Ramos up there in my 2008 broadcast and promised you a follow-up. Okay, Edwin Ramos. Edwin Ramos is a native and a citizen of El Salvador in Central America, which is not quite as much of a basket case country as Afghanistan, considerably thanks to remittances from Salvadorans in the USA. Those remittances form 17% of El Salvador's GDP. The country didn't suit Ramos, though, so in 2000, at the age of 13, he came here to join his mother, a refugee from El Salvador's civil war that ended in 1992. Ramos came here under temporary protected status on a 10-year visa. I didn't know that at the time of my 2008 broadcast. Nobody knew it. It only came out a couple of years later. Along with everyone else, I assumed he was illegal. Once here, Ramos promptly joined the MS-13 street gang and embarked on a criminal career. In 2003, he was convicted of assault and gang membership. He was deportable, that visa notwithstanding. A non-citizen who commits crimes is always deportable, whether present here legally or illegally. However, Ramos was not deported. After being released on probation, he mugged a pregnant woman, and then he got off the hook again with probation and went back to the streets again. Again, no deportation, although he was now doubly liable. In March 2008, Edwin Ramos was arrested as a suspect in the gang murder of two young citizens, but was released for lack of evidence. This time, local probation officials did contact ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as Ramos was by now an adult offender. ICE did nothing. 3 months later, in June of 2008, looking for revenge after a gang buddy had been shot, Ramos found himself cut off in a narrow street by another vehicle. Either mistaking the occupants for gang enemies, or, just from road rage, Ramos shot dead the other driver, American citizen Tony Bologna. For good measure, he also shot dead Mr. Bologna's two sons,
Michael, aged 20, and Matthew, 16. Mr. Bologna's third son, Christopher, though he's called Andrew in some of the news stories, I don't know why, age 18, was unhurt. Mr. Bologna's wife, Danielle, had to hear the news that she had gone from having a husband and three fine sons to having just one son. She also has a much younger daughter, Lucia. In the brouhaha that followed, it came out that San Francisco's juvenile justice system had been bending over backwards to prevent non-citizen juvenile offenders from coming to the attention of federal authorities. Mrs. Bologna tried to sue the city on the grounds that their sanctuary policy had let Ramos loose to kill her menfolk. But the city, which might at least have offered the poor widow a settlement, fought tooth and nail and won in superior court without even offering her an apology. What does the grief of a bereaved citizen matter against the importance of coddling immigrant gangbangers? Well, Edwin Ramos is now on trial for the murder of Tony Bologna and his two sons, after a 3.5 years delay. What took so long? That is an interesting question. Part of the answer is politics. Both the DA and the lead prosecutor were up for election to higher positions in the 2010 cycle. They didn't want the Ramos case and the associated Sanctuary City issues casting any negative light on their careers. There was also the matter of a big federal racketeering case against 29 members of Edwin Ramos's MS-13 affiliate. That case was tried last year. Ramos himself was not one of the accused, leading to suspicions that the feds had been running him to get leads. That, the suspicious minds said, was why he'd been let go by ICE after that shooting incident 3 months before the Bologna murders. ICE itself said there was a documentation foul-up. Whatever the truth of that, the fact remains that 3 decades of sloppy unconcern with who's getting into our country and being allowed to stay has given us a hideous alien gang problem that cost the lives of Danielle's husband and sons. As the Ramos trial came up, in fact, Danielle and her surviving kids had to leave San Francisco and go into witness protection because of rumours that MS-13 was going to silence them. Law-abiding citizens bereaved by alien criminals are driven into witness protection, parted from their friends and neighbours, while those criminals run free. This is the USA in the year AD 2012. We are the suckers of the world and the dupes of the age, the great fools of all time, handing over our lovely country to alien psychopaths while sending our sons to fight and die on behalf of high-living embezzlers who regard us with scorn and contempt. This is us. This is the USA, laughingstock of all the world's crooks and hustlers.
That clip included a mention of the San Francisco DA being up for election to a higher position in the 2010 cycle. The DA won that election and got that higher position. California State Attorney General. What was the name of that ambitious, duplicitous DA who showed such cold indifference to the distress of Danielle Bologna? Her name was Kamala Harris. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. There'll be another trip down memory lane next week when I shall look at Radio Derb commentary during that same period, 2004 to 2012, commentary on our presidential elections with special reference to podcasts from the same point in the 2008-2012 cycles as we are currently at for the 2020 cycle. A point, that is, a year and 2 months before the actual election. Who knows? Perhaps that will give us some guidance as to what to expect next year. Until next week, this is your nomadically genial host, John Derbyshire, wishing you joy of these last few days of summer.